The waitress brought their pancakes and sausage and refilled their coffees. As Paul drenched his plate with maple syrup, he began talking again. 2 years ago, we had a big bankers' convention in Vegas. Mona was with me. She got bored, went to the room. I got bored, so I walked along the strip, late at night. I ducked into one of the older casinos, and guess who I saw? Tessa Canyon. Tessa was shuffling booze, a cocktail waitress in one of those tight little costumes that's low in the front and high in the rear. Bleached hair, thick makeup, 20 or so extra pounds. She didn't see me, so I watched her for a few minutes. She looked older than 30. The odd thing was how she performed. When she got near her customers at the tables, a smile came on with a purring little voice that says, "Take me upstairs." The glib one-liners, the bumping and rubbing, shameless flirting with a bunch of old drunks. The woman just wants to be loved. I tried my best. She's a sad case. That's why I dumped her. She won't come back for the funeral, will she? Maybe. If there's a chance she'll bump into you, then yes, she'll be here. On the other hand, she ain't looking too good, and with screamer looks are everything. Her parents are still here? Yeah. A chubby man wearing a John Deere cap eased to their table as if he was trespassing. "Just wanted to say hello, Neely," he said, almost ready to bow. "Name's Tim Nunley, down at the Ford place," he said, offering a hand as if he might be ignored. Neely shook it and smiled. "Used to work on your daddy's cars." "I remember you," Neely lied, but the lie was worth the effort. Mr. Nunley's smile doubled in size, and he squeezed Neely's hand harder. "I thought you would," Mr. Nunley said, glancing at his table for vindication. "Good to see you back here, Neely. You were the greatest." "Thank you," Neely said, releasing his hand and grabbing a fork. Mr. Nunley backed away, waiting to bow, then took his coat and left the restaurant. The conversations were still muted around the tables, as if the wake had already begun. Paul finished a mouthful and leaned in low. 4 years ago, we had a good team," he said. "Won the first 9 games, undefeated. I was sitting right here, eating the same thing I'm eating now, on a Friday morning, game day, and I swear this is true, the topic of conversation that morning was the streak. Not the old streak, but a new one. These people were ready for a new streak, never mind a winning season or a conference title or even a state championship. They're all peanuts. This town wants 80, 90, maybe 100 wins in a row." Neely looked around quickly, then returned to his breakfast. "I've never understood it," he said. "These are nice folks, mechanics, truck drivers, insurance salesmen, builders, maybe a lawyer, maybe a banker, solid small-town citizens, but not exactly earth-shakers. I mean, nobody here is making $1 million. But they're entitled to a state championship every year, right?" "Right. I don't get it." "Bragging rights, Neely. What else can they brag about?" "No wonder they worship Brake. He put the town on the map." "Take a bite," Paul said. A man with a dirty apron approached, holding a manila file. He introduced himself as Maggie Renfro's brother, now the chef, and he opened the file. Inside was an 8x10 color photo of Neely at Tech. "Maggie always wanted you to sign this," he said. It was a splendid picture of Neely in action, crouching behind the center, calling a play, ready for the snap, sizing up the defense. A purple helmet was visible in the right lower corner, and Neely realized the opponent was A&M. The photo, one he had never seen before, was taken minutes before he was injured. "Sure," he said, taking a black marker from the chef. He signed his name across the top, and for a long moment looked into the eyes of a young, fearless quarterback, a star biding his time in college while the NFL waited. He could hear the Tech crowd that day, 75,000 strong and desperate for victory, proud of the undefeated team, thrilled that they, for the first time in many years, had a bona fide All-American at quarterback. Suddenly, he longed for those days. "Nice photo," he managed to say, handing it back to the chef, who took it and immediately hung it on a nail under the larger photo of Neely. Let's get out of here, Neely said, wiping his mouth. He placed some cash on the table and they began a quick exit. He nodded, smiled politely at the regulars, and managed to make an escape without being stopped. Why are you so nervous around those folks? Paul asked when they were outside. I don't want to talk about football, okay? I don't want to hear how great I was. They drove the quiet streets around the square, passing the church where Neely was baptized and the church where Paul was married, and the handsome split level on 10th Street, where Neely lived from the age of 8 until he left for Tech. His parents had sold it to a certified Yankee who'd been brought down to manage the paper mill west of town. They passed Rake's house, slowly, as if they might hear the latest just by driving down the street. The driveway was crowded with cars, most with out-of-state license plates. Rake's family and close friends, they figured. They passed the park where they played Little League baseball and Pop Warner football. And they remembered stories. One that was now a legend in Messina was, of course, about Rake. Neely, Paul, and a handful of their buddies were playing a rowdy game of sandlot football when they noticed a man standing in the distance, near the backstop of the baseball field, watching them closely. When they finished, he ventured over and introduced himself as Coach Eddie Rake. The boys were speechless. You have a nice arm, son, he said to Neely, who could say nothing in response. I like your feet, too. All the boys looked at Neely's feet. Is your mother as tall as your father? Coach Rake asked. Almost, Neely managed to say. Good. You'll make a great Spartan quarterback. Rake smiled at the boys and walked away. Neely was 11 years old at the time. They stopped at the cemetery.